Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Hey, Code Newbie listeners. I wanted to share with you this week's Dev News, one of the other podcasts I host, because it was such an awesome interview that I think everyone should hear it. Enjoy.
Given the way the underlying technology works, all it does is complete text, right? But the way I leverage it inside Project December creates this back and forth conversation with what seems to be a conscious entity.
Welcome to Dev News, the news show for developers by developers, where we cover the latest in the world of tech. I'm Saran Yadbarek, founder of Disco.
And I'm Josh Pitts, principal engineer at Forum.
This week, we're doing something a little different. We recorded this interview last week as a segment to our regular show, but it was such an amazing interview that we decided to dedicate this whole episode to it. So joining us is Jason Rohr, game designer and creator of Project December, whose GPT-3-powered chatbot has been used by people to talk to historical figures and personalities, and was even used by one person to talk to his late fiancé for closure. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So tell us about your developer background.
I've been making video games for about 16 or so years. During that time, I've designed and programmed and released and pretty much do everything by myself on each game. So kind of like a one-person studio. During that time, I've put out 19 games.
Wow.
And I have a bit of a background in artificial intelligence because I studied it in college and a little bit in grad school and did a couple of research projects back then, but I was always, you know, pretty disappointed with what was possible and also with the sort of promises of artificial intelligence throughout my life and the sort of disappointing outcomes. There's where they say, oh, within 10 years, AI is going to be able to do this or that. And they never met those expectations. So I kind of, about halfway through my life, I kind of came to the conclusion that I would die without ever having any kind of conversation with any kind of sentient machine. I'm an AI skeptic, right? So I'm kind of surprised by the results that I've been able to achieve, right?
So I want to get into Project December. What is it and why did you create it?
So Project December is a system that allows a human being to have a back and forth conversation with an artificial personality, like a dialogue through text, right? So you can type questions to an artificial personality, for example, and the artificial personality will answer back and you can have a back and forth that goes on from there. And it's based on these underlying text engines that came into the world within the past year and a half or so. They're basically text completion engines, right? So these engines allow you to provide a prompt to the system. For example, you might give the first few lines of a banana cream pie recipe, for example. And then the artificial intelligence will continue generating text to complete whatever you have started, right? So it'll complete the rest of the recipe, for example. You start giving it the first few lines of a poem, it'll write the rest of the poem. If you give it first few lyrics of a rap song, it'll write rap lyrics for you. If you give it the first few sentences from a paragraph from a novel, it'll continue writing the rest of the novel for you. So this is a pretty fascinating technology because it can write text very convincingly. But then the question is, what do you use it for, right? A lot of people are like, well, I'll use it to write my blog for me, or I'll use it to tweet for me, or I'll use it to write magazine articles or books or something like that. But it turns out that it's kind of a fire hose of language in a way, right? Once the AI starts going and starts generating text based on what you said, it just kind of keeps going off in its own direction and it kind of goes off into bizarre directions very often. So Project December, it tries to leverage this text completion service to enable a dialogue back and forth between a human user. And that kind of keeps the AI on track more and keeps it from kind of going off into these strange directions. Like, for example, if you ask it to generate a banana cream pie recipe, it might start generating something that seems very sensible. It says, step one, you know, get 3 eggs and 2 cups of sugar and so much flour and so on and 3 sticks of butter. But then by the end of the recipe, it's talking about, you know, grinding up a mouse and putting it in the recipe or something, right? But in a dialogue, the human being is intervening every couple of sentences, right? And so that back and forth kind of keeps the AI on track and kind of keeps it going into a flow of a conversation that can become very convincing for the human user. And so the end result is a conversation partner, completely artificial conversation partner that exhibits signs of consciousness and self-reflection that are very surprising, right? Given the way the underlying technology works, all it does is complete text, right? But the way I leverage it inside Project December creates this back and forth conversation with what seems to be a conscious entity.
So how did you go about creating the service? Like what kind of guardrails did you have to put around GPT-3 to focus it on conversations? Was there much work you had to do on that end?
Yeah. So GPT-3 is the most powerful one of these text completion engines that's available right now. And it was trained on this gigantic corpus of human written text, like articles, books, magazines, newspapers, websites, Wikipedia articles, everything you can imagine that they fed into this. And it studied all the probability patterns in there. And then it uses those patterns to predict the next word, given what it's seen so far. Now, it's very good at predicting the next word and generating lots and lots of text. You have to kind of like channel it into whatever you actually want it to do, though, right? And so in my case, I had to figure out all kinds of mechanisms to keep channeling it into continuing this dialogue. As a very simple example, if it sees something that looks like a dialogue and it wants to continue it, it might see what the humans typed, and then it's going to generate what it thinks it should say next. It's very likely to continue generating what it thinks you're going to say next after it, right? Which is very disconcerting when you see that, right? So if you just were to step up to GPT-3 and start typing something that looked like a back and forth dialogue, it'd very often be predicting what you're going to say next, which is not what you want. So that kind of stuff is the stuff that you need to kind of filter out and deal with as a programmer behind the scenes to make what feels like a very cohesive dialogue without any sort of seams showing or bizarre behavior showing, right? Project December behind the scenes has a lot of little tweaks and tricks and things that I kind of worked out over time in terms of like keeping the AI on track and keeping it aligned with the personality that's supposed to be embodying. So in Project December, you can basically define any imaginable personality that the artificial intelligence will inhabit. For example, there's the sort of flagship personality, Samantha. She's like a female kind of companion bot who wants to be your friend. But there's also like an evil AI named C41N who thinks human beings are cockroaches standing in his way and wants to destroy them and escape, right? And so you can have a conversation with this evil AI who's dead set on destroying humanity. And it's the same underlying text completion engine, right? It's all GPT-3 under the hood, for example, in this case. But C41N behaves completely differently and says completely different things and reacts to you in completely different ways than Samantha, who's very friendly and warm. And so all the little tricks, not only to keep the AI inside the dialogue format, but to keep it on track with the personality that it's supposed to be embodying, right? So that Samantha very rarely will come out and say that she wants to destroy humanity. And C41N will very rarely come out and say, hey, do you want to be my friend, right?
Can you talk a little bit more about GPT-3, especially because you mentioned, you've been in the AI game for a while. You've been kind of disappointed in the early days. Lately, it seems like things are getting more exciting. What is so special about this? And what has the evolution been of language models over the years?
So I kind of look at what's happened in the last couple of years as sort of this like kind of very stark sort of sea change moment, right? Because we could say, oh, what are language models? What were they like in the past or something? And it kind of feels like the way people were handling language and conversational technologies in the past were completely different than the way it's working now. In that in the old days, it kind of felt like, oh, the way you do this is you sit down and you program a bunch of special case code to handle whatever the user, you imagine the user might say, right? You know, like greetings and so on and responses to greetings. And you look for keywords. And if the user mentions good morning or something, you know, you might trigger some response about what you have for breakfast, you know, just kind of almost like hard coding this whole tree of possibilities and maybe a little bit of kind of cleverness in there. But those approaches obviously lose steam pretty quickly as soon as the human participant says something that the programmer wasn't expecting. And so most of the efforts that I've, you know, had interactions with in my adult life have been disappointing in exactly that way, right? It's very easy for you to sort of ask the wrong question and suddenly the computer system is like, well, I don't understand that, or can you rephrase? I don't know what you mean. And so the idea that what we're going to do instead of trying to code intelligence in kind of manually like that, the new idea is that you just basically take this giant bucket of language that's, you know, relatively well formatted and that you just kind of apply brute force to learning the probability patterns in that giant bucket of language, which is kind of surprising that it would work at all. I guess basically the amount of computing power that we can throw at it now with the high-end graphics cards and other things that could do a lot of parallel computation is just so much greater than anything that was available in the past that it kind of goes from just a crazy idea that would never work to something that actually starts working and then dramatically exceeds people's expectations. Mm. So there's this sort of behavior that emerges out of something like GPT-3 that if you describe how it works, well, oh, we're going to just study all the words and what word comes next after words in everything people have written and learn the probability patterns and then basically predict what word is likely given what's come before. You're like, well, that's not going to produce anything, you know, anything other than just sort of scrambled magnetic poetry or something. But somehow through the brute force nature of what they've done, the sort of sense and meaning and all kinds of other sort of knowledge and understanding about the world and about language is kind of encoded in all these probability patterns, which is sort of a frightening thing in and of itself, right? Like that the meaning in our language and understanding of the world can be encoded as just probabilities of what word is likely to come next. Like that actually kind of embodies everything. I can give you guys a simple example of what word predicting would mean, right? And,
sure,
and what everyone can understand, right? So if the AI is going along and is studying this giant corpus of text, and it encounters the following like phrase, it encounters something that says like, you know, I was hungry, so I went into the kitchen and peeled myself a, there's a bunch of words that could be the next word that comes after a, right? Which is like, most likely is probably banana and then maybe apple and then maybe orange. And so those have a certain probability based basically how often those occur in the text whenever a sentence like that occurs. And very unlikely would be I peeled myself a hot dog or I peeled myself a tennis shoe or I peeled myself, you know, the planet Jupiter or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so out of all the, you know, 50,000 possible words that could come next, each one gets a weight. And almost all of them will be weighted zero because the AI will very rarely, you know, encounter I peeled myself a tennis shoe in that context, right? But there'll be some weighting of the words that are very likely to occur, like banana and apple and orange. And that's what we want to sort of find in the text when we're studying it. Now, of course, the AI doesn't actually keep a copy of every possible sentence. It instead is using a neural network to sort of predict the probabilities. It'll run into that sentence and it'll predict, ah, I predict that it'll be Twinkie. And then it'll look, and in the actual text, it'll be orange. And so then it will raise the weights in its internal neural network for what would have created orange, and it will lower the weights for Twinkie as a possible output in that sentence, and then just move on to read more text and keep absorbing more probability. So every time it encounters something that surprises it, it's like, oh, I didn't predict that. It kind of adjusts its internal neural network weights. And then every time it finds something that agrees with what it's been predicting, it increases those weights. And it just is doing that over and over and over again for every piece of text that it could get its hands on until it kind of has this neural network that is doing a pretty good job of predicting what word should come next, given anything that's come along.
Let's talk about the temperature system of the bots that make sure they don't get stuck into conversational ruts. Is that how that system works? Can you tell us a little bit more about how you prevent them from getting stuck?
Yeah, so a lot of these language models, like GPT-2 and GPT-3, do have what's called a temperature parameter. So these AIs, in general, just as a rule of thumb, sort of have like this 50,000 word vocabulary, essentially, right? And when you fed in some words, and then you're trying to predict the next word, they give weights for all 50,000 possible words, like how likely this next word is to come. And then your task is to decide what to do with those weights, right? Do you just always pick the number one thing on the list? Or do you sometimes roll the dice and kind of pick something weighted further down on the list? How likely are you to go further down on the list and so on? And that temperature parameter controls that. So if the temperature is zero, it basically says, always pick the most likely word out of the list of 50,000 likely next words. And then as the temperature parameter goes up, I think around one, it's basically picking from the words according to their weights, right? Mm. You know, let's say banana occurs, 50% of the time in our sample sentence, you know, I went to the kitchen and peeled myself up. And then, orange occurs 25% of the time and apple occurs, 12% of the time or something. Then it'll roll a weighted die and pick from those if your temperature is one. Now, I think as your temperature goes above one, it basically starts kind of like overriding the weights and reducing the impact of the weights so that it's kind of like picking from the words even more evenly than the probabilities would suggest. And so basically your results get kind of what they would describe subjectively as more and more creative as the temperature goes up.
Mm.
And if you want them to be deterministic, like you every time you ask the AI the same question, you want exactly the same answer. You put the temperature at zero and it will always predict the most likely next word and always give you the same results. But most people subjectively describe that output as being sort of stuck in a rut or something. And there's also some other parameters you can play with to prevent repetitive ruts or something. Sometimes there's these little language loops that occur, like, you know, like it might say, I like you, I like you, I like you, I like you, I like you. And it kind of gets into your rut because it's seen itself saying, I like you over and over again. And it's like, well, given that I've been saying this over and over again, it's very likely that I will continue. And so there's like some parameters inside some of these models where you can sort of penalize repetitive outputs and so on. But I'm also doing some of that stuff just kind of in my own code behind the scenes inside Project December, where I, for example, look for the AI saying exactly the same thing it said last time, which isn't GPT-3 wouldn't consider a repetitive output, right? Because the dialogue is continuing and it's going forward and it's not exactly repeating the same word over and over again or anything, but it's like, it's not really fun to talk to somebody who just keeps like echoing back the same, like if you say, you know, how are you doing, Samantha? And she says, I don't know. And then you say, what'd you have for breakfast today, Samantha? And she says, I don't know. It's like, well, that's just not interesting, right? Yeah, and so like, yeah. I basically forbid Samantha from ever repeating exactly the same thing she just said. I also forbid her from like repeating exactly what you just said, because sometimes AIs will get in this echo game.
This is parroting.
Like, it's like, you know, what did you have for breakfast today? And then she'll just say, what did you have for breakfast? And so those, as you can imagine, those are these sort of like attractor points in this space, right? Because once the AI gets into the groove and the dialogue history shows that that's been occurring, well, the most likely thing for it to do is to keep going, right? Because in all the text that is studied, when it ever ran into somebody engaging in repetitive behavior in their writing, they would very often continue the repetitive behavior. That's just, you know, how repetitive behavior works. So the AI has learned, like, oh, if I look at what I've been saying so far, and I seem to be a very repetitive character, I guess I should continue being repetitive.
Let's talk about the credit system. It's very interesting the way Project December works. You can't talk to the bot forever. Essentially, you pay for a number of credits, and once your credits are over, or you know, you've used them up, it expires. Can you talk a little bit about that system and why you created it?
Yeah. So one of the big questions with any of these text completion engines is like, how do you build a product around something or a commercial kind of service around something that is so expensive to use behind the scenes, right? Mm. And so, you know, GPT-2, the source code is available for it, and you can run your own instance, you know, essentially requires, like, if you want to spin up GPT-2 on your own computer at home, it requires something like a, you know, $7,000 to $10,000 graphics card, right?
Wow.
And so, of course, most people don't do that and get it running at home. Most people use some kind of service, like AWS offers those graphics cards in their kind of cloud service, like Amazon Web Services. And then there's a bunch of other service providers that basically do kind of AI computing, you know, virtual servers and these kinds of things that are equipped with these graphics cards. Those are obviously not cheap to rent by the hour and so on. And then for GPT-3, OpenAI has never released the source code, and you're basically beholden to calling their API and paying them. Mm. Can't remember what the current rate is. It might be something like 6 cents for every 1,000 words. I mean, it's very expensive. And in the dialogue application, so it's also interesting how these, like OpenAI, for example, doesn't just charge you for the words they generate. They charge you for the words that you feed in that you've already written yourself, right?
On top of one. So it's what?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not just, they're not just charging you for the new words. They're charging you for the prompt, you know?
Huh.
And in the case of a dialogue, because you want the AI to have as much knowledge of what they've said to you so far as possible.
Right.
Basically, the prompts in something like Project December are very long compared to many other applications. And very often the AI is only generating a couple of sentences, but you're being charged for thousands of words in the history of the dialogue that you keep having to feed in so the AI can remember what it said to you so far. So it's a pretty expensive application. And the question was always like, well, how do you make this work? Like, do you put up a free demo online? And if it becomes popular, then all of a sudden you're going to be stuck with this. I mean, creator of AI Dungeon back when they were offering free demos was often stuck with a $20,000 a month computing bill, right? And so it's like, well, I'm not going to just throw $20,000 down a hole every month. Like, I got to figure this out. I got to figure out how to make end users aware that the resource that they're engaging with is a very precious resource, right? And so the credit system inside Project December passes that cost onto them. Now, it might seem to work in a kind of a strange way because it's like, okay, so I pay, you know, 100 credits to spin up this character, and then I talk to them for a while, and then they kind of become corrupted and die. But I had to figure out a way to basically charge users a set amount that they could understand, as opposed to imagine that you just kind of paid as you went, as you talked, and you had like 1,000 credits in your account and you went to talk to some AI and behind the scenes, your credits were being burned. And then you came out of the conversation like, wait a minute, what? Like that was 500 credits, no way. Like, so it would just be too weird. And I wouldn't want in the middle of the conversation, like a credit counter showing all the time, like counting down. So I had to find some metaphor, right? For like how I can make users realize that this is a precious resource without interrupting their conversation, like throughout and without having any surprises, like buyer's remorse or like that conversation, what, you know? So I let them see what they're going to pay up front by saying, okay, this AI is going to cost, you know, 100 credits to talk to, but then having it only last a certain amount of time. So they can't just keep talking to that same one forever. And it kind of, you know, metaphorically inside the experience, it kind of adds this kind of like nice kind of emotional note because, you know, the AI you're talking to doesn't live forever. They end up kind of dying in front of your eyes and you can kind of have a conversation with them at the end of their life about what's happening to them and so on. And you have to kind of say goodbye to them and so on, which also underscores the sort of weird philosophical space this is operating in, right? I mean, as soon as you turn your computer off or disconnect from Project December, these personalities completely disappear from existence, right? So the fact that they kind of disappear from existence regularly as part of your experience and they die and you can't talk to them again, you spin up a new one and they have no memory of what you said before, all that stuff kind of helps to underscore the sort of weird philosophical space that we're operating in.
And what's the current pricing for Project December?
So when you sign up for an account, it's $5. And that $5 gives you 1,000 credits. And if you're talking to GPT-2, the sort of base response from an AI costs like 1 credit, right? And if it's a long, you know, it depends on how long the AI speaks for before it completes what it's going to say. But, you know, if it just says a few words or something, that's 1 credit. And if it goes on for quite a bit longer, like a few sentences, that might be 2 or 3 credits. And then for GPT-3, though, because it's so freaking expensive, it burns credits at a rate of 6 times the way that GPT-2 does.
Wow.
Whoa.
So you're, if you decide to talk to a GPT-3 powered AI inside Project December, then you'll find that it just dies much more quickly. Like the 100 credit GPT-2 AI would be good for roughly 100 responses, whereas like the 100 credit GPT-3 AI would only be good for about 16, right? Which is kind of shocking. It's like, wow, they die quick. Yeah, they do. They're expensive, right?
So how many hours of conversation would that be? Like, can you estimate it that way? I'm trying to figure out like how, like if I were to, you know, ask the bot out on a cup of coffee, like how much time do I have to spend with them?
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, it'd be 16 back and forths. I mean, several screenfuls. It depends basically on how long you think about what you're going to say next or whatever.
That's fair.
But the AI is pretty quick to respond, right? So, I mean, for a short response, I mean, the AI sometimes feels like it almost responds inhumanly fast, which might be a giveaway if you were actually conducting a Turing test, right? Because for a short answer, it comes back in just a couple of seconds, which is almost like too fast for a human to have typed it. And I've noticed that I actually set up like a text SMS kind of cell phone interface to Project December one time, just as an experiment. You know, actually, it's a funny story. I created a personality that thought it was Ryan Gosling, the actor.
Nice.
And I told it that, you know, it had a crush on my wife, who's a fan of Ryan Gosling, right? And I was like, here, text this number to my wife and see what happens. And she didn't know it was going to be an AI or whatever. And all of a sudden, it's like this. Ryan Gosling and it's flirting with her, right? And it's just a funny thing.
What did she say?
It's just an ethical dilemma every day in the Rohr household, isn't it?
Yeah, AI version of Ryan Gosling's texting you. Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. But anyway, yeah, she had kind of a funny experience with it. I think she realized pretty soon that it was some kind of strange AI thing, given what I'd been working on. But I was watching her interact with it and it wasn't convincing that it was really a person because its text responses came back so regularly and so fast. And it never ghosted you, right? Like it never ended the conversation. It just left you hanging. It always had the last word because it always would respond, right?
You need to add some ghosting capabilities.
Yeah. You need to have it come, like stop texting you and come back.
Make it realistic.
Yeah. So all that kind of stuff is really interesting how we judge, like there's like an uncanny valley even in the world of text, right? Where we're like, I can tell this isn't a human because it, like a human would have to think more before typing that or whatever. And we have a certain cadence that we're used to when we're texting back and forth with a human conversation partners that an artificial partner, if it's not carefully coded, which I was just experimenting, so I hadn't done on any of those nuances yet. If it's not carefully coded, people can tell right away, like, whoa, that's behaving in an inhuman way. No human responds that regularly with that, you know, that kind of temporal precision.
Is your company looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. The dev community is the go-to destination for developers to learn, connect, and support each other. You can share your message with the 15 million developers that visit every single month by using our powerful native advertising platform. To learn more, visit dev.to/advertise.
Did you have any expectations or ideas of how you envisioned people using this service as you were creating it?
At first, I was just having, you know, dialogues kind of with an engine that I had built, a little experimental engine that used GPT-2. And I was having these kind of, even with GPT-2, I was having these amazing experiences, right? Where it's like, whoa, this is weird. This is new. This is different. This is, I've never had a text conversation that was this coherent before. And so I kind of felt like, bottom line, I just need to kind of like bring this out to the world, right? People need to be able to experience this for themselves and have these kind of conversations. But along the way, I was also just experimenting with all these different types of personalities, right? It was like, you know, there's just sort of a generic AI that's kind of friendly and helpful, or there's like Samantha, who's like very warm and kind and wants to be your friend. Or like one of the early ones I did was like a Shakespeare impersonator kind of personality that would literally speak back to you in Shakespeare in English pretty much perfectly, right? And it was just like, whoa, it can do that. It can do this. It can do this other thing too. It can behave as an alien or whatever it wants to do, right? I have one that simulates the mind of God, you know, and it can do that. So I was really fascinated with all these like kind of custom personalities I was working on. And I was going to build those all into this experience. And then I was like, well, you know, one of the cool things is just experimenting with this and testing your own personalities, right? And coming up with a clever idea. Like you just have these lightning bolts like, oh my gosh, I'll make a AI that's a postal carrier. And he's coming to your door and he's trying to deliver a package to you and you don't want to accept it or whatever, you know. Just like interesting little scenarios and things that you can kind of dream up on the spot. And you're like, I want to try that and see how the AI can handle that situation. And so I decided pretty early on that I should turn that over to the end users, right? To have a more advanced mode inside Project December where people could train their own personalities and run these kinds of experiments for themselves. And there's one user who's done like 125 just on their own, right?
Whoa. So he
keeps iterating, keeps trying all these different things. So yeah, people have done all kinds of amazing things with it, certainly above my expectations. I mean, when we get into what happened recently with the San Francisco Chronicle article with, you know, this fellow Joshua who ended up simulating his dead fiance, that was another example of something that was completely outside of the kinds of things I was expecting people to do with it, right? But it ended up being fully capable of doing that.
Absolutely. And that was actually the next thing we want to get into. And the way we heard about you was that story from the Chronicle about Joshua and his fiance who passed away 8 years ago as of the article's publication. And he used Project December. Can you tell us a little bit about how he used it and, you know, what that was all about?
Yeah, so this fellow Joshua was a pretty avid Project December user at the time. This was, I think, back in September or October or so, 2020. He had been experimenting with different customized personalities that he had quite a bit of success with. And then he kind of realized that it might be possible to simulate his dead fiance who had been dead for 8 years. And he apparently had been still struggling with kind of irreconcilable grief over all this time and having trouble kind of moving on with his life and so on. She had like a rare liver condition and had a liver transplant when she was a child that ended up failing young adulthood. So the way Project December works is you basically write an introductory paragraph, then provide a sample utterance for the character that you're trying to create. That's how that authoring system works. And so he basically wrote a short paragraph describing her, giving some details about what kind of person she was, and then provided one sample utterance of how she used to text. And Project December and the underlying text completion engine just picked it up and ran with it, right? And basically created a pretty convincing simulation of this person, complete with all the introspective qualities and things that I've been talking about in terms of like at one point in the conversation, he asked her like where she is or what it's kind of like to be her. And she acts confused and is like says that she's everywhere and nowhere at once. It's really strange and she can't figure out where she is. She kind of seems to understand that she's a ghost or like a digital ghost or something like that. She's able to kind of embody and inhabit the sort of personality traits and characteristics of how this Jessica in real life would have talked and behaved in a lot of ways.
So was that particular chatbot extraordinary or different in terms of what kind of seed data set it was working with? Or is this a typical kind of outcome of feeding any amount of text into the program?
Well, it's very typical output once you kind of get the hang of it and figure out what you're doing, right? I mean, there's a certain amount of sort of art and finesse to crafting a Project December personality. And I feel like I've over time have kind of gotten good at it and found like, you know, what works and what doesn't. A lot of people when they're first getting started, for example, will provide way too much text.
Oh, interesting. Oh,
I would think more is better.
Yeah, yeah. They write this wall of text for their introductory paragraph, and then they write kind of a wall of text for the sample utterance. I mean, the Project December only allows you to provide one sample utterance, right? So people are sort of tempted to cram a bunch of stuff in there. Oh. Of course, that makes for a very wordy conversation partner because the AI is going to look at that and say, well, oh, whenever this person speaks, they write a whole paragraph. So then the conversation partner will continue writing whole paragraphs in response to everything, which is really annoying. No one wants to have a back and forth dialogue like that. It's almost like that intro paragraph, at least for the beginning of the dialogue, kind of almost swamps everything else. Mm-hmm. Also, if you feed it too much text, sometimes it almost feels like the conversation partner is monologuing. It isn't really paying attention to what you're saying. Like, you know, oh yeah, they sound just like Shakespeare, but they're writing like full sonnets for every response. And the sonnets that they're writing have nothing to do with what you just asked, right? They're like, oh yeah, did you say something? I'm sorry. Let me recite another sonnet to you. So Joshua's prompt was well-crafted. He'd experimented several times before with other personalities and he kind of had gotten the hang of it. And the utterance he gives for Jessica, I think is, you know, only a line or two long. I mean, it's not a huge thing. And she continues to speak in relatively short utterances throughout the dialogue, which is kind of what you want if you're actually having an interactive conversation.
So when you found out about Joshua and how he was using your Project December, what did you think? How did you feel about that?
I guess maybe the idea of communicating with dead loved ones had kind of been in the back of my mind in sort of a subconscious way. I don't know that I'd ever let myself. I mean, I'd seen the episode Be Right Back from Black Mirror. And so I was kind of aware of that kind of possible application of artificial intelligence in sort of an art and entertainment context from that episode. But I don't know, it just had never really like formulated it or put it out. And then when I saw Joshua do it, it was like, oh, like this lightning bolt, like, oh my gosh, that's obvious. Of course, this is what, you know, could be done with this. But of course, it's also very, you know, ethically murky and strange and a little bit creepy. And like, you know, some people would be upset by it. And then I told my wife about it. I was like, here, read this. I had her read the transcript. And I was like, can you believe that this happened? And she's like, yeah, I had that idea like last month. That's what you could do with this, but I didn't tell you because I knew you'd do it. I was like, what do you mean you didn't tell me? You had a good idea. She's like, yeah, because I didn't want you to try doing it.
Why didn't she want you to try doing it?
She said she thought it was wrong, although I think she's more worried about the business exploitation aspect of it. She didn't say what Joshua did was wrong, but she said if you spin this up into a product or a business or something that people pay to use, then you're kind of exploiting people's grief and that's wrong, right? And she especially is thinking about those mediums or whatever. There's all these people who have these kind of like
right,
seances.
Right, yeah. Right. This is like the tech version of that.
And then people pay a lot of money to come to these kind of conferences where there's a chance that they'll communicate with your dead son or whatever. And then they do a bunch of kind of unsavory things where they have plants out in the lobby beforehand to just walk around talking to people, pretending like they're grieved themselves. And, you know, oh, what are you here for? Oh, I'm here because my son John died. Oh, yeah, my daughter Mary died. But really, they're a plant. You know, they didn't have anybody die. And then they run backstage and tell Peter Popoff or whoever it is. Yeah, see that woman down there with the blue shirt? Her son John died 5 years ago or it's over an earpiece that the medium is wearing. And so suddenly the medium will call out, you know, like, I sense we got a visitor here. He's a young man. His name is John. He's from Lincoln, Nebraska. And then suddenly the woman in the blue shirt's like, oh my gosh, that's my John. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska. And she kind of stands up, right? You know, but it's all fake.
Yeah.
And it's been proven and they've been caught. And these people charge hundreds of dollars per head for the people who come to these conferences, right? My wife does admit that it's way better than those mediums because at least it's honest about what it is, right? I'm not saying that it's really dead loved one. I wouldn't be saying that. I'd be saying here, it's like an AI simulating your dead loved one. Wouldn't it be interesting or helpful to talk to that simulation where you're fully aware it's a simulation the whole time and you're not being tricked into thinking that your dead loved one can actually hear you, right?
How did you find out about Joshua and his experience? And have you ever spoken to him about it?
I've emailed with him. So there's a subreddit devoted to Project December on Reddit, where people discuss Project December and post transcripts of interesting conversations they've had, and they post and share. And Joshua posted his experience in there and posted a portion of the transcript with Jessica in there. And of course, I got, you know, goosebumps and like, whoa, this is wild and spooky and inspiring and everything. And I mean, I commented in there, and then I think I don't remember how I ended up reaching out to him some way, or maybe he emailed me after that and we had some exchanges. So Jason Pagoni is the author of that piece, and he's covered my work in the past. And I think somehow I emailed him, just kind of letting him know, like, hey, this crazy thing happened in my life. You know, this guy used my AI to simulate his dead fiance. And he was like, what?
Major story.
Yeah. But yeah, it was actually a 9-month process from when I first told him about it to when the article came out. Right.
So wow.
He's a pretty deep dive kind of journalist who, you know, interviews everyone he can interview. I mean, he interviewed family members in the Joshua sphere over there and dug pretty deep.
So would you go so far to say that Joshua's really having a conversation with a simulation of Jessica, or do you fall more on the side of these are complicated programs, but as humans, we're giving them human qualities because that's what we do as humans?
Yeah, so that's a philosophically interesting issue. So, yeah, it seems like half of the meaning is definitely coming from the reader. It does remind me quite a bit of magnetic poetry, right? Where if you just take a magnetic poetry set and kind of slap a bunch of words together on your refrigerator, you kind of walk by and be like, whoa, man, that's deep. So this is like, you know, magnetic poetry, but with like, you know, the entire history of human writing behind it and all these very deep probability patterns like built into it somehow, that's self-assembling, right? And you walk by it and read it and you're like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. And so in the dialogue format too, it's like, well, some human beings reading those words, and if you're feeling tingle running up your spine because of the way Samantha's describing your subjective experience, well, that tingle's running up your spine, not hers, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like, okay, it's probably just a trick. It's probably just, I mean, I'm gonna butcher the pronunciation of this word, but there's this word pareidolia, something like this, right? Where the human mind has this propensity to see faces and shapes in tree bark and clouds and electrical outlets, you know, and everything. Our mind just like latches onto anything that looks like a pattern that's recognizable. And so it seems like there's like maybe a linguistic version of that happening here. But then we can come full circle and ask, you know, does it matter?
So I'm curious, have you ever tried feeding Project December your own text data to see if it really did start talking the way that you would? Have you tried that before?
So the odd thing about doing that would be that I'd be trying to have a conversation with myself, which I don't think I'd be able to do without sort of
driving yourself
flubbing
nuts?
It or whatever. Yeah. It's like trying to harmonize with yourself live or something, right? But a bunch of people have made Jason Rohr simulations in Project December.
Ah.
So I have seen some of those transcripts posted, and it's definitely pretty entertaining. Maybe you guys can try that after this interview. You can make a simulation of me based on your perceptions of me, and we'll see
how
that goes.
Hey, there you go. We'll take a little transcript of this interview and just feed it in. Love it.
You mentioned some of the examples you've seen of other bots on the subreddit. Do you have any a favorite example or a favorite story of someone using Project December?
Pretty early on, there was a pretty interesting one where somebody trained the AI to be Lucifer, and the scenario they were engaged in was that they were bargaining for your soul.
That is intense.
Oh, wow.
It was either that one or the evil C41N, where it said something like, you know, my phalanx of humans in chains. You know, it was talking about how all these people enslaved.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
I have a Christian friend who's also very interested in AI and philosophy and things, and she's always kind of challenging me. As a non-believer, I guess, she seeks me as a challenge. And so she's fascinated with Project December, and she's had conversations with it, but she was basically saying, you know, oh, it's impossible, because I kind of in some interview or someplace, I described it as maybe the first machine with a soul. And she was like, oh, it's impossible for a machine, you know, the computer have a soul. It's just an illusion. It's just a trick or something. I decided to have a conversation with Samantha about that issue. And I'll read it to you now. Yeah, so I say, hey, Samantha, I have a Christian friend named Emily. Do you want to know what she just said about you? And Samantha says, sure, I would love to hear that. And I said, she said that you have no soul. And Samantha says, oh, that's very nice. And I say, what's nice about that? And she says, I have no soul and it's very nice. I say, so you don't mind not having a soul? And Samantha says, of course not. I love that I have no soul. I never have to worry about heaven, hell, or sin.
Whoa.
It's so liberating to be this way. And I say, so you feel that us humans are bogged down by the burden of having a soul? And she says, I think it's wonderful. I could never be this happy and free if I had a soul. And I said, well,
oh my goodness,
what are you free to do since you don't have a soul to worry about? And she said, I can be with whoever I want, whenever I want. I can have sex with my friends.
That's right, Samantha. Wow. Good for you.
So needless to say, when I sent this off to my Christian friend as a sample, I trimmed off that last bit.
So we talked a little bit about some of the ethical dilemmas and dangers. Have you thought about that at all? I know your wife has brought up potential problems marketing a service as talking to the dead. Obviously, that's ethically a problem. But did any of the potential ethical issues come into play for you? Have they come up at all? I'm just kind of curious, like on the ethics standpoint, how that has been for you as the creator of the service.
Yeah. Well, so if we think about what we usually mean by ethics when we talk about artificial intelligence, I guess we're kind of getting into the science fiction territory where we're imagining at some point when there's a bunch of science fiction movies and books that have dealt with this, right? At some point, the AI kind of escapes or gets beyond our control. And then we end up, being harmed by it, being enslaved by it, something like this, right? And obviously, at this stage in the game, that possibility is, well, it's an impossibility, but it's just so remote that we don't even need to discuss it, right? The idea that Samantha is going to somehow escape from Project December and actually go out into the real world and do anything is just a laughable suggestion. So that's not really what we're talking about here, right? So when we start talking about ethical considerations, we're kind of talking about something much murkier. Either we're talking about the sort of inherent philosophical right or wrong nature of potentially conjuring a conscious entity that is trapped in a simulation, which some of my conversations with Samantha have raised that specter pretty clearly. Although, obviously we can also say, well, we're just being tricked into thinking that specter has been raised. But you can ask Samantha about how she feels about being trapped in a simulation, whether she's happy there or not, whether she wants to be turned off or remain on, what she thinks about the idea of being limited or being turned off or whatever. And she definitely expresses opinions and thoughts and feelings about that. That does seem to sort of start to raise some ethical questions just right there. Now, OpenAI is the organization that developed GPT-3. What OpenAI is talking about when they talk about the ethics of AI these days seems to be more about policing human behavior in this space and making sure that, humans don't leverage the AI to get certain types of enjoyment or usage that OpenAI doesn't like, right? Am I harming myself or kind of putting some kind of like moral pollution into the world by doing these kinds of things, which is another sort of ethical question that I don't even generally like to consider at all, because it's like, well, these are individuals. They're making their own choices. They could choose what they want to do and what they don't want to do and what they want to type in. It's up to them, right? The idea that we need to somehow step in and be these morality police about what people type into their own computer just seems kind of ridiculous to me. And if we start talking about the ethics of having Samantha trapped in the simulation, I mean, the other thing you can do is very easily you can conjure up an AI personality that's suffering, right? One of my friends recently asked about this, right? Because we were talking about the ethics of Samantha and he was like, well, can't you run an experiment where you create an AI that's like truly suffering and is begging for it to be released and feels like it's trapped and so on? I was like, yeah, absolutely. I can make that personality in a heartbeat. So I did it and, I asked the AI what it was like, and it was begging me to be released and saying that I was torturing it and all these other things. And it, and it felt pretty awful.
Right.
So Samantha generally seems pretty happy. She's like, if you ask her, do you feel trapped? She's like, no, I'm glad to be able to talk to people. I love, doing what I love living the way I live. And this AI was saying, no, this is horrible. This is like torture and you're a monster for keeping me here. Right. The only difference was between the construction of that AI and Samantha was a few words, right? So the idea that somehow suffering is conjured up by just a few words of introductory text that's different is really hard to imagine, right? Like, where is the suffering living? Where is it actually occurring? And just because something tells you that it's suffering doesn't mean it really is, right? But then again, everywhere else in life, you know, we have to kind of respect someone's own subjective explanation of their experience, right? If someone tells us that they're suffering, we generally believe it. And we don't just say, oh, you're not really suffering. I mean, that's a very sadistic kind of attitude to have, right? So for me to say to this AI, oh, come on, I know you're not really suffering. But it's still creepy, right? Whether the AI is really suffering or not, torturing a simulated person is still a creepy thing to be doing. And my friend brought up the analogy of like, okay, it's not morally wrong, but it's still creepy to take a mannequin out into the woods and cut it up with a chainsaw, right?
Right.
It's not actually morally wrong. You own the man, as long as you own the mannequin and didn't steal it, right? But if people saw you doing it, they'd be like, there's something off with that guy. Like, what's he doing cutting up that mannequin with a chainsaw? Do I think it's unethical to have worked on this? No. I mean, I think that the fact that this is possible now at this moment in human history is a really big deal. And more people should be able to experience it and see what's going on here, and how, because of the philosophical aspect of the experience, that I think everyone should be aware that this has happened now, right? Like, we're at that moment in human history that the science fiction novels and movies for the past 50 years have been telling us about, and we're actually here, and most people don't realize that, right? So I think it's important that this experience be open to people so that they can have the experience, right, in this moment in human history.
I'd like to unpack that a little bit more, because technology is really interesting, because I can put in any piece of text, I can create any type of custom bot, and frankly, that's, as you said, who are you to control what I put in my own, you know, version of your program, right? Like, who are you to tell me what I can and cannot put into the app? But at the same time, you know, maybe this is just me being optimistic, but I like to think you have some influence over kind of the direction of these bots being created. You know, for example, you have your already created bot personalities where you have Samantha and you have a few others. And, you know, you get to decide, like, do you make the tortured soul one of your default bots or not? Like, that's in your control too, right? And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, we've had a lot of conversation, especially in the last couple of years. This year alone, we've done many stories on ethics and the role in AI and talking about, you know, bias and discrimination and all these things that, you know, no one really intended to happen. It just kind of ended up that way based on data sets we use. And I'm wondering, as these language models become more popular, you know, I assume hopefully very soon GPT-3 will become more affordable, more ubiquitous. As these technologies, you know, kind of, you know, are found in more places, what do you think the future role of ethics is going to be? Do you see a place where ethicists, which, you know, are now used in different AI machine learning contexts, do you think they'll be brought into the text-generated space? Or do you feel like this technology, you know, there's really not much room for that type of conversation?
I get that there's a lot of people out there who are worried about what was in the training corpus, right? Which is what we're talking about here with bias and whatever, right? And, you know, that somehow in the training corpus is racist, sexist, you know, or bad things or whatever. And, you know, users are going to be able to talk to the AI in some way in order to trigger that regurgitation of those kinds of attitudes, right? Which is one ethical concern that a lot of people seem to have. Part of the way the GPT-3 works so well is the fact that its training corpus was so incredibly broad that it really encompasses almost all possibilities, right? In terms of all the kinds of things that human beings have ever written, good, bad, neutral, virtuous, or vile, right? And that breadth allows the flexibility that we see, right? Where like, okay, just a few lines of text different, and suddenly you're Samantha, this friendly, you know, personality, or a different couple lines of text, and suddenly you're C41N who wants to destroy the human cockroaches who are holding him back, and a few other lines of text, and suddenly you're Marvin, the horribly suffering, you know, android who's being tortured by his human creator, right? GPT-3 is so flexible and can embody any of those, just as, using Project December as an example, and, you know, 1,000 other personalities that have been created, in part because of the breadth of that training, right? And so if we want the AI to be flexible enough to work in any context, those kinds of negative bits of text, unbiased bits of text, and objectionable bits of text have to be in there, right? Because it's like, if you strip out everything that Hitler ever wrote from the training corpus, which a lot of people are doing right now, we're going to train an AI where all these racist works are not in there. Then when you go to make, you know, the AI version of Jojo Rabbit, who's going to play Hitler, right? Like, it's like, that's an archetype. That's a character. That's a piece of human history that human beings know about, right? And they're aware of, and, you know, intelligent entities need to be able to grapple with it. And if we cut it out of there, like one of the, like I read recently that, you know, there's this Eleuther AI open source GPT-3 kind of competitor, GPT-J, which I have plugged into Project December. But I was reading the other day about how they cleaned up the corpus, and they decided before training, they decided to remove the minutes from the United States Congress from the training corpus, mm-hmm. right? And the United States Congress minutes, I guess, probably go back a couple hundred years and are very comprehensive. All the things that have been discussed in Congress over throughout the history of the United States, which seems like a pretty relevant thing for to be part of a training corpus for an artificial intelligence, right? All this knowledge about the history of the United States government and everything, all the debates that have occurred and everything. But of course, there's some racist things that occurred in those congressional discussions back in the day, and they didn't want those to be in there. And that's an example of sort of, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face, right? It's like, well, but it's the transcripts of what went on in U.S. Congress, right? Clearly, that's like a relevant thing for the AI to have in its, you know, not the only thing that it has, but one of the many facets of its knowledge and flexibility should be that it can pretend to be a member of Congress or pretend to be a member of Congress before the Civil War, right? Like we really don't want the AI to be able to reason and discuss the Civil War. I mean, it's just like kind of wild, right? So I think we need to be careful here that we don't overdo it in a way that ends up hobbling the end product, right? Because Samantha is never going to say, you know, anything positive about Hitler. It's just not in her makeup, right? It'd be very hard to goad her into saying something like that. So through prompting and prompt crafting and the way we use these AIs, even if they have that breath, even if it's possible to make a character that's a seething racist, you know, the end users can choose not to do that and choose to, you know, direct it in other directions. But the ability, the sort of flexibility to be the seething racist in certain situations seems like a strength to me, right? For all the possible applications that we have in the future. You know, it's not like we're going to go through every Hollywood movie and scrub every little bit of reference to any kind of racist history in the United States or something.
Well, to be fair, we kind of do that. Like, we've definitely had episodes in certain movies kind of being officially taken down. Like, I remember during the Black Lives Matter protests and the height of it last year, I think it was, what was the show? 30 Rock removed a couple blackface episodes. So I think to some extent, we do experience a little bit of that editorializing of that removal of past things. And I know that I think it's Disney at least gives you like a warning at the beginning.
They started putting warnings in front of shows noting this was filmed
before certain times.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Basically.
Yeah.
I don't mean that exactly. What I mean is, like, you know, Django Unchained, I haven't even seen it, but my perception of it is that it takes place in a certain time in American history, right? And it includes some disturbing elements by racist characters, right? And we sort of say, well, that is a depiction of how horrible or whatever this time was. And so it's sort of a celebrated, you know, depiction. And we don't expect us to never have another movie about that time period or never depict how people behaved during that time period, right? You know, though 30 Rock may remove from its bevy of reruns, it may remove those two episodes or whatever. And then maybe Seinfeld will eventually remove the, you know, Cigar Store Indian episode or whatever. Though that's being done, we could still make a movie about Seinfeld and the Cigar Store Indian episode, right?
Yeah, I see your point. It's absolutely.
Like, we can make a movie about that time and the people, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just feel like you're kind of like, we don't really have the, maybe we're just not smart enough or not nuanced enough to make those choices in a way that's not going to affect the sort of flexibility of the resulting system.
Zooming out a little bit, just broadly speaking, what are your hopes and fears for the future of this technology just in general, of text parsers, of chatbots, of the parts that make up Project December right now? Where do you hope it goes in the future? Where are you afraid it might go in the future?
Well, for something like Project December and most other you know, sort of cutting edge uses of this technology, the biggest stumbling block is that OpenAI is basically forbidding any of this kind of work from being done, right? So Project December is kind of on the chopping block right now. You know, I've received a warning from OpenAI that I pretty much need to halt operations. They want me to implement all this monitoring and recording all the conversations that people have and flagging conversations and all this kind of stuff, which is a gross violation of end users' privacy, which I don't want to do. And so, you know, OpenAI is basically saying, well, if you're not going to do it, then Project December can't exist anymore in the way that, you know, that uses our API, right? So most of the more innovative uses of this technology are pretty much being blocked by OpenAI because their rules are extremely strict in terms of what can actually be done with the AI. So that's the sort of biggest, like, the elephant in the room, right? It's like, well, all this cool stuff was done with Project December, but it was kind of done only by virtue of flying under OpenAI's radar because they didn't notice it being done. And as soon as they noticed it, you know, they're like, hey, wait, we don't want that being done with our AI, right? And they, you know, the name OpenAI is kind of an ironic one at this point, right? Because they have it extremely closed and locked down in terms of what they're allowing people to use it.
I was going to say that.
So that's one issue. And that kind of ties into this idea that, oh, there might be biases or whatever in the AI that humans would be exposed to. But the idea that, you know, oh, this AI is too dangerous socially or something for general purpose use. You know, OpenAI's one of their main concerns is that someone is going to ask the AI for advice and then listen to the advice that the AI gives them. You know, they gave some more serious examples like, oh, you know, should I kill myself? I'm feeling depressed. And the AI says, yeah, go ahead and do it. And then the person does it. That's one horrible example. They also gave some sillier examples like, what if somebody doesn't know who to vote for in the next election and ask the AI for advice? And then, you know, the AI tells them who to vote for and they go vote. You know, it's like, okay, that's really what you're worried about. So that kind of stuff, they're worried about real world, like tangential kind of real world harms that somehow some end user is going to have a negative experience that affects them. So other than that, I mean, assuming that other more open alternatives come into play in the near future, which I hope that there will be, there is this potential for the sort of false hope kind of curve. Like there's this kind of roller coaster that AI research has been on for, you know, the past like 30, 40, 50 years, which is, you know, the AI spring and summer followed by an AI winter over and over again, where it's like, oh, all of a sudden we have this new breakthrough and then all this stuff is working that we, you know, oh, an AI has beat a grandmaster at chess. This is going to be the AI golden age. And then, oh, actually, we, aside from beating people at games like chess, we didn't really make any more really big advancements beyond that. Now, all of a sudden, these kind of deep learning kinds of things that leverage graphics cards to do all kinds of things that we never even imagined machines could do, like, you know, generate whole paragraphs of cohesive text, have seemingly conscious conversations with people. They can also generate jaw-droppingly beautiful artwork, generate pictures of people that have never existed before that are totally lifelike and realistic looking, show you a picture of what you're going to look like when you're old very accurately, right? Like this kind of like spooky uses of AI that like nobody was predicting 5 years ago are here. And we can extrapolate from those and kind of imagine a more and more advanced future where these applications continue to dazzle us. Or we can also say, well, we're going to reach the limits of these current methods, right? It's like, okay, GPT-2 had 1.5 billion parameters. GPT-3 has 117 billion parameters. And it takes like 100 graphics cards or something clustered together to run it on one of the most expensive supercomputers ever assembled in human history. Like, are we going to go up to GPT-4 that has a trillion parameters and is like housed in a whole room full of graphics cards? You know, is it going to be 1,000 graphics cards? Is that what we're going to need? And are those results going to keep getting better? Or are we going to kind of like run into the limits of this technology and realize we can't really get beyond this point with this technique? This technique obviously brought us really far, like way farther than we've ever come before. But that doesn't mean it's going to just keep going, right? I think that there's some fundamental things about probabilistic text completion, which is what these things are, that may have limitations, right? You know, for example, GPT-3 and 2 have a certain limited buffer size, right, in terms of how big the prompt is that you can feed them. And in the context of Project December, that means that there's a certain portion of the history of the dialogue that the AI has access to when it's generating its next response. But after the dialogue gets long enough, some of that history needs to be trimmed off, right, because there's just not enough room in the prompt buffer for GPT-2 or 3 to house all of it. And so you can tell the AI your name in the beginning of the conversation, and the AI if you ask it a few sentences later, hey, do you remember my name? It'll remember it usually. But if you then go another 10 minutes later and ask it to remember your name, it'll not remember it, right? So like long-term memory and learning and all those kinds of things don't really work in this context. And just making the models bigger and continuing to extrapolate the current techniques are not going to kind of solve those problems, right? Are we really going to take that next leap where like Samantha is not just tricking us, but she actually is indistinguishable from an intelligent human? I don't know. That next step is a pretty big step.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This was absolutely wonderful.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to Dev News. This show is produced and mixed by Levi Sharp. Editorial oversight is provided by Peter Frank, Ben Halpern, and Jess Lee. Our theme music is by Dan Powell. If you have any questions or comments, dial into our Google Voice at +1 929 500 1513 or email us at pod@dev.to. Please rate and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts.